Attention, all hands. As you know, we could outrun the Klingon vessels, but we must protect the Enterprise C until she enters the temporal rift. And we must succeed. Let's make sure that history never forgets the name. Enterprise. Picard out.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, stepping into a looser uniform and growing a beard.
And this week, we are here to rank the TNG seasons.
Cam, what makes like a good, solid TNG season to you? Are you judging it based on like standout stellar episodes or moments? Or is it more of kind of a cohesive factor where you look at the season as a whole and you're like, you know what? Even if there's not as many standout episodes, it's a little bit more of a consistent season that I'd be happy to wash up ashore, and it's my only personal item that I have on this desert island.
I find TNG far more difficult than when we did original series and animated series. And it's also harder for me than probably DS9 or, you know, like a Discovery would be, where you can look at the arc of the season and say like, okay, this season's arc wasn't as strong as last season's. With TNG, it's kind of peppered all over the place. I mean, it is more of an episodic show. So what I did was the same as I did with our previous season ranking episode, where I went through every season and I broke them down to the hell yeah episodes, the really good episodes, the sure episodes, and the hell no episodes. And so it did become very difficult for me in my ranking to decide at a certain point. You know, there's a couple that are kind of obvious, you know where to kind of put them in the list. But there was a few where I'm like, well, this one had like four hell yeahs. This one has consistency across the board in the good column. So I feel like my ranking, while I have a rank set, you know, on paper right in front of me, I feel like it's a little open to movement because some of these seasons are really strong and it's tough to really, it's not like comparing, you know, like First Contact to Nemesis. And I'm talking about the films, not the episodes. It's like the difference in quality between a few of these seasons is pretty similar. Like they're very close together.
Yeah. And for listeners, Cam and I, we're going to have to come to a consensus. Like, so I'm open to movement. I can be flexible, although I think I'm pretty solid on what my number one season is. But we're going to start, you know, from worst go to first. And Cam, maybe I'll throw this at you at first go around here, because I think it might be somewhat controversial. You might disagree, but maybe we can, one of us can convince the other. But as the worst season of Star Trek The Next Generation, the one that kind of makes me just like weirded out a little bit whenever I see it come on like a rerun or what have you, it's season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation. That's my ranking for the worst one. I know we've got kind of the Guinan factor, who I think you mentioned a few weeks ago, that she really does start to give this anchor to the series that we didn't have before. But I look at the episodes that are there, and you've got Measure of a Man. And then I'm scratching my head as to what the other real standout episodes are, the ones that I'm really excited to watch once again. And if you've got other factors, you know, Riker's getting his beard, that's cool. They're kind of figuring the characters out. Pulaski is there, and your mileage will vary on her. I'm okay with her, but it's also a reminder that, you know, Crusher isn't there in the season anymore. And that's kind of a weird kind of gaping hole in kind of the series holistically with Wesley's mom just, you know, chilling at Starfleet Medical. Am I wrong to, you know, put season 2 this low?
I had season 1 as the worst. And for me, season 2, like, there is not a huge battleground between these two seasons. They're both quite poor in the realm of Siege, in the realm of TNG. But for me, season 2 also had Q Who, which is like a super strong episode, I thought.
Okay, yeah.
And I like the episode Matter of Honor as well. It's not like a, it, obviously it's not up against the other two that we've named, but to me, it also had just more good episodes in season one. Like, season one didn't have a single hell yeah episode, as I call them. Like, there was nothing in that list. Like, I was really only looking at episodes like Data Lore, Conspiracy, or Neutral Zone as like my, these are pretty good episodes. And other than that, almost everything fell into the sure category with, you know, there was definitely a few hell no's in there as well. So season two, I felt like there was enough ones that were, you know, decent. There was enough sures. It felt a little more spread out. But in your defense, there are a number of horrible episodes as well. So I don't know. It felt like it was consistent in that there was episodes to fill every category in season two.
Well, I'll just put it this way. Like, I was looking through, like, the episodes in season two, and I like, you mentioned some very solid, you know, standout ones, but, like, just, I think, like, way more worse ones. I also think it's, like, one of the worst episodes ever, and just Shades of Grey. Like, that is a terrible way to end your season. But you also have just things like the Defon, you know, like, where Silence has Lisa. You started off with the child. Like, that is your... Think about your premiere and think about your finale. This one's, like... There's some okay episodes, you know, like The Emissary. You know, I think Elementary Dear Data is kind of fun. I just...
Peak performance is fun?
Yeah, yeah. I'm looking at the TNG season one episodes, and I don't know. Like, I'm not going to, like, die on this hill. There might be another hill I'll die on down the road. Do you want to consider doing season one as the worst of all of Next Generation?
Season one? Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Okay. I'll say this in your defense. I think it's also a totally legit argument if you just point out Yar's death as one of the most egregious things to occur between those two seasons. I can't really fault you for that. But it is so weird that you're coming off of Yar's death, and their answer to that is, you know, well, let's kind of get rid of, well, not get rid, but like Gates McFadden also leaves and you have Pulaski come in. And I think just kind of where the characters are just, it's definitely like a downgrade, like going into season two.
The Crusher factor is huge in season two. Like, losing that character matters a lot. And I think there's a lot of people who would almost dismiss season two because of that. And I don't blame them. For me, though, it's tough. I feel like they were working a little better with character dynamics maybe in season two. Like, they'd figured out a little more of the Riker. Like, season one Riker is so weird. Like, you could do a whole podcast episode of, like, weirdest season one Riker episodes because they're so strange. You also get more of the establishment of the Data and Geordi friendship in season two. Like, there's elements of it they're figuring out. I think Picard is getting a little more hammered down. Like, season one Picard is a little strange. Now, to my memory, correct me if I'm wrong, are there less Wesley Saves the Ship episodes in season two?
I believe there are, because there were a whole lot, especially just kicking off the series. It wasn't as much fun to watch, right?
Yeah, like, it's not a drastic evolution of TNG in season two, but it feels like they're creeping towards something. Whereas I feel like season one, a lot of the time, they're lost in the woods. They're trying to, like, replicate original series style episodes with things like really bad ones like Code of Honor, Angel One. Like, these feel like something the original series may have done in probably a better way, but it feels like TNG doesn't know what it is at this point.
I'll still go back to this. I think fundamentally you and I are coming at this differently, in that you had arranged your list in, you know, kind of hell yeah episodes versus no good episodes. Whereas I'm looking at them and I'm thinking of the seasons more holistically, you know, like, what are the seasons where I'd rather just kind of have all to myself? There's more consistency there. I think we should, like, consider what drew us into, say, the original series, which I think for most people is going to be the strength of the characters, especially the Spock, Kirk, and McCoy dynamic. There's really no comparable, like, dynamic or breakout characters at this time. Sure, Data is kind of interesting, but it's not the character moments that I think we so just loved in those first two seasons, and even season three of the original series. It just, you hit the nail on the head when you said, like, the characters are just really weird early on in seasons 1 and 2 of Next Gen.
I mean, in your mind, do you kind of lump season 1 and 2 together of TNG in sort of this, like, when you're thinking about the show, Star Trek The Next Generation, you're kind of like, eh, skip those two.
Generally speaking, yes. And yeah. I, you know, like, they're not... They are not the most beloved amongst the fan community at large either.
They are tough to watch. You know, your girlfriend recently sped through seasons 1 and 2 of TNG, and I admired her for doing it because I have rewatched, I just started a rewatch of TNG a while ago, a very casual rewatch. And I started with season 3 because I was like, do I really want to watch the old Admiral in, you know, season 1 TNG? Like, do I want to sit and dedicate 45 minutes of my life to rewatching that episode again? Like, I've rewatched Q Who, Measure of a Man for this podcast a couple times now. I can pick and choose from, like, seasons 1 and 2. I can find some of the campy fun episodes, like, you know, Justice in season 1, but it's really tough to just sit down and barrel through 26 episodes of season 1 TNG.
All right, well, I'll let you have this one. Why don't we go season 1 as the worst, followed by season 2 after that. And
I've got one more point, actually. Season 2 is shorter, ergo it is better.
Okay, I can totally buy that argument as well. But I'm just saying, look at the season premiere, look at the season finale. That it was just, those are the worst bookends you can imagine. Like, think about the bookends to season 1, like Encounter at Farpoint. It's actually an interesting jumping off point. And then you end up with the neutral zone, which is kind of, it plants seeds for what is to come in season 2 to a certain degree with the introduction of the Borg, the Romulans, etc. I just, those bookends for season 2 are just terrible.
Is there a Star Trek show that has comparable, like, bookends? Like, I don't know that there's anything worse than this. Like, season 1 Voyager, you have learning curve at the end, but at the upfront you have Caretaker, which is really strong.
To answer your question, no, I don't think there is. Like, even like with, say, Star Trek Picard, which overall we weren't big fans of, but I think we, you know, the Remembrance, the series premiere, we thought that was fairly strong. It had a couple moments in the finale, but I think that might be the only one that could battle TNG, and both cases led by one Patrick Stewart.
Actually, you know what? I thought of two more. There's also season 3, the original series, where you have Spock's Brain and Turnabout Intruder. Not great. I think Spock's Brain is really fun, but that's not a great bookend. And also Enterprise season 4, where you have the Stormfront two-parter, and close it off with These Are the Voyages.
You know what? Maybe that Enterprise one. I just still think that... you know, I think Shades of Grey is just... It's terrible. It's a clip show. And the child is just like... It's... Oh, this is tough. I still go to season 2 TNG as the weakest bookends, followed very, very closely by Enterprise.
I think the thing about Stormfront is it's not good, but you can at least write it off and be like, okay, well, it resolved the temporal Cold War. The child doesn't resolve anything.
No, no. All right, well, now going to what we would rank, I guess, as, you know, the 5th best season of Star Trek The Next Generation. Cam, you know, I kicked it off. Do you want to tell me what your thoughts are for number 5?
Sure. So for number 5, I put the last season, season 7 of TNG. And for me, it just came down to, when I'm breaking it down, there's some really strong episodes that we do continue to talk about all the time. Episodes like Parallels, obviously the series finale, or Lower Decks. But it feels... less so than some of those middle seasons, like they were hitting the really strong line a lot less. Like, we were getting to the point where there was a lot of kind of shoulder shrug episodes. It felt, well, to be fair, this is season 7 of a 26 episode a season run. I don't blame the writers for being tired. They're also, you know, the Berman Company is working on DS9. It just feels like their attention was getting a little frayed, and sort of those, the ideas they had early on for really great Star Trek episodes, it was running thin. So for me, season 7 falls into that category.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with you there. It's like, It's a lot of, like, really bland episodes, and I think that might be the worst indictment. It's not that they're just outright terrible like we got in, you know, seasons 1 and 2. It's just they're so incredibly forgettable, you know? Like Picard being tempted by love on that alien planet. I think that was episode 2. I'm blanking on the name of it. Let me just look it up right here.
Is that Liaisons, maybe?
Liaisons, yeah. And then that one is followed up by Geordi's mom in Interface, and it's like, okay. And then a couple episodes later, it's like Dark Pay. It's just like these are not strong entries, and you're going into your final season here.
Yeah, I had 2 like Hell Knows, and they were actually the Interface, that Geordi episode, as well as Masks. Those are the real low end of this season. A lot of people would also put Sub Rosa in there. From a quality perspective, it's hard to disagree, but it's such a weird episode that I kind of bumped it up to the sure category.
I also think about the fact that, like, if you're in your final stretch of episodes, you've got stuff like Firstborn, you know, with Alexander Rodchenko traveling through time to encounter his younger self. You've got Bloodlines, in which Picard might have a son, but not really. You have Emergence, which, you know, the Enterprise becomes sentient. It's like, this is not how you kind of close out your series. You finally do have something with Preemptive Strike, which offers closure with Ro. But other than All Good, like, I think All Good Things really does save the legacy of TNG in a way. I don't know if we would have been thinking as fondly of TNG now had it not been for that series finale.
Right, like, if it had a ending like These Are the Voyages, it would be very grim.
Not even These Are the Voyages, just something much blander, like forgettable, you know? Mm. Like, maybe something more like Endgame.
Right, right. And you know how a lot of shows, if they run long enough, they get weird? Like, I think of the final seasons of Seinfeld where, like, Kramer's acting like a dog, or Family Matters, which lost its mind and had, like, time travel and robots. Season 7 TNG gets kind of weird. And some of the weird I enjoy. Like, I think Genesis is a super fun episode. Phantasms is a really fun episode, I think, with, you know, Data's weird dreams and stuff like that. But when you're getting episodes like those two, Masks, Sub Rosa, it feels like that point where the writers are just kind of throwing things against the wall to see what sticks, and things get really strange.
Not in a good way.
Yeah, yeah. And even an episode like Lower Decks, which is a triumph, probably wouldn't have happened earlier in the series.
I remember this one time at a convention where Marina Sirtis was just totally, you know, bagging on Deep Space Nine. And it was great because people started booing her in the audience. But she claimed that the producers started taking great TNG Season 7 scripts and handing them over to Deep Space Nine in Season 2. Mm-hmm. I want to know these exceptional Deep Space Nine scripts that ended up getting turned into episodes that they had stolen from TNG, because in that final season, because that does not make any sense to me, what she was saying.
Yeah, it really doesn't, unless you really want to do the a la Moraine scene.
Well, she would have been a season behind, though.
Yeah, true. Because, like, what is there in, like, Season 1 DS9 that would
No, Season 2 Deep Space Nine. Because that would have been Season 7 of TNG.
Oh, right, right, right. Okay. Yeah, like, what is... I have no idea what she'd be talking about.
Yeah, so... but you could just kind of sense the writers were out of gas at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, it's not a terrible season. Like, I would say Seasons 1 and 2 are pretty terrible. Season 7 is just kind of underwhelming. It's not how you really want to go out, but you have some good stuff in there. And, you know, I'll also mention Attached is an episode I really like, which is the Picard-Beverly episode where we kind of delve into their relationship. You have the Pegasus, which would pay off so much, you know, it would contribute so much to canon by the time we got to the end of Enterprise. it has a lot of very strong episodes, you know, mixed in with the kind of the meh, but it is it's a bit of a tough season.
I think underwhelming is a perfect descriptor there. Jumping over to the 4th best season of Star Trek The Next Generation, we might start to diverge here, but I feel that Season 3 would follow Season 7 at this point. Like, it doesn't start off super strong, But it does take like a big leap forward compared to the previous season. I don't think it's great if you're starting with an episode like Evolution and then you come back with The Survivors. It's not until like Who Watches the Watchers that I think, you know, you got Michael Piller there telling everybody, we need to make the episodes centered around our main characters. Make our main characters the ones that we are invested, not the guest star of the week, not the high concept of the week, but the people that we are going to be there with, you know, 26 episodes a year. He kind of cracked that nut, and a lot of pieces were put in place by the preceding producers, but it was just, it's remarkable to see how quickly they're able to take like just this exceptional cast and really kind of deliver the material that I think that they were worthy of for the preceding two seasons. But Cam, do you disagree with me about where I would like to play season three?
I don't, actually. I also noted season three at this placement. For me, it was one where I almost felt bad because I'm looking at the episodes that I ranked at the top, you know, the Hell Yeah episodes. And, you know, you reference Who Watches the Watchers. I had that listed, but you've got The Enemy, The Defector, Deja Q, Yesterday's Enterprise, The Offspring, Sarek, Best of Both Worlds Part 1. And so I felt almost guilty ranking it this low when you've got some of the hallmarks of TNG listed right there. But you are right. Like, it starts slow, and there are a number of very, very middle-of-the-road episodes mixed in. It's just that, like, they figured the show out at a certain point, and they're hitting home runs. You just have to kind of, you know, sift through a little bit, because I don't know if you really want to sit through, you know, Tin Man or The Bonding that much.
Well, it's actually a good point that you are bringing up, or at least a good reference with regards to The Bonding, because if you want to point to a character that they start to, you know, develop off layers to, you've got Ron Moore coming in, and he says to the writing staff, look, I feel like I've got a hold on who the characters are, and I could give some material for somebody like Worf, who had been very one-dimensional up until that point. You give him an episode like The Bonding, it's not our favorite, but then they're kind of working with it. We follow that up with Sins of the Father. They're giving layers to characters like Worf, who they really kind of struggle to, you know, pin him down other than him just being more kind of like a brutish force aboard the ship.
Yeah, and they also, obviously working off of Measure of a Man, really run with Data, where you get The Offspring. You get the most toys. Like, they really are understanding how to use Data, which is really exciting to see. Like, that is my favorite part of really any TV show, is when they really lock in on a character and know how to use them on the show.
I wonder, do you think too many people just simply think of this as the Best of Both Worlds season, and then maybe they elevate it in its standing a little bit more than it deserves?
I think a lot of people ignore The Ensigns of Command or The Price. You know, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, who cares about those episodes? There's so much else. I think that is a big part of it. And to me, also, season three, if you're rewatching it, it also feels like the show is starting to have fun with itself, with episodes like Captain's Holiday or Hollow Pursuits with Barclay. Like, it feels like a show that is understanding its own mythology, and like, it doesn't feel like a show that's having that much fun in seasons one and two, whereas season three, they're locking on their characters, but they're also saying, what if we just have some fun episodes? Like, the original series had fun with its characters time to time. Let's just do that.
There are also some certain signposts about, for me as a viewer, that signal that this is kind of where Star Trek Next Generation is figuring itself out. That is the return of Crusher. We also have new uniforms, and I know it sounds a little silly, but I really think the show goes a long way in, you know, becoming more dignified to a certain degree by not making all the characters, except for, I guess, the background actors, walk around in tight, like, as if they were superheroes or something.
I do think uniforms play a role. I think any aesthetic, I mean, that's part of the, you know, the mise en scène. That's what people are looking at and drawing a certain atmosphere from. I think people might have a different feeling even about, say, the motion picture if the crew is all wearing those red uniforms from Wrath of Khan. There's something about the vibe you get from those spandex uniforms in season one and two TNG, and that they're kind of junky looking. Like, I'm sure they were expensive to put together back in 1987, but they look kind of cheesy.
Also, like, they haven't aged well, whereas the standard TNG uniforms, those have aged well. I've literally worn one to Halloween at a bar where there's a costume contest there. You know, like, I don't mind that. Whereas I don't know if I'd be walking around in the season one uniform just in my daily life.
Although now that you've said that, wouldn't it be kind of funny to wear the season one uniform to like a convention?
Only if I'm dressed up the next day as the folks from Justice.
Have you ever seen anyone wearing a season one? I've seen someone in a scant before, but you know, like the season one scant that some people would wear. But I don't think I've ever seen someone in the spandex uniform.
I bet we must have, but like it was just such a fleeting glimpse that it didn't stick in our head. But like, it would not surprise me if, in fact, it's just like a confabulation on my part, you know?
Mm-hmm. And there's something also about those uniforms that clash with the tone of what early TNG is. Like, I think TNG is trying to be a more contemplative series than what the original series was. Obviously, when you have Picard as your captain, that's going to kind of go hand in hand there. And putting him in like a spandex uniform kind of takes away from the maturity of the series. Whereas when you get to those more regal outfits in season three, it feels like it's actually matching the tone of the show with the actual aesthetics of the characters.
Well, Cam, why don't we jump over to the next season? We're getting into the top three, and my argument, I'll let you tell me what your answer is, but my argument is, like, these top three seasons, though, TNG is in its, you know, defined period, you know, the era that people always kind of romanticize here, in which, yeah, there are some stinkers, it happens, there are a couple duds, they're, you know, maybe a little bit sluggish to watch. But the show really is running at all cylinders at this point. The consistency is there to a degree we've never seen before. This is really kind of what makes me excited about the next generation. But where would you slot as, you know, I guess the third best season of all of Star Trek The Next Generation?
This is where it was killer. This is where I really struggled, right? Because I was like, okay, it's like, which of these fantastic TNG seasons is the worst? I had slotted in season four. I'm open to arguments, I suppose, but, it was because when I looked across and, I just want to note, actually, I did not have a single Hell No episode in season three, which I thought was notable. But with the other ones going forward, I felt like season four, there was fewer episodes I was passionate about, even though it has a incredibly consistent run of very good episodes.
I will not argue. This is actually where I slotted number four as well. And it's interesting, like, okay, you got the best of both worlds, you know, wrap up there. Sure. I think people are bigger fans of that episode in their own memory than it is in practice, at least for you and I. Then you followed up with family. You followed up with brothers. Like, this show is starting off very strong. You're also giving some closure to a character like Wesley with a great episode like Final Mission. And there's just fun episodes like Clues, which I think that one is just like an absolute kind of like whodunit kind of mystery to a certain degree about why a lot of things aren't making sense if there's like random broken bones that you can't explain aboard the ship. The Drumhead Cam, like, this is one of my all-timers. And this is really, I think, TNG at its peak, where it's bringing in that sense of gravitas, talking about issues that seem both universal as well as very contemporary all at once. Like, this is just kind of an exceptional season. This is, like, I think TNG's first all-out exceptional season at this point.
Yeah, and I actually had First Contact as well in the Hell Yeah category. Like, it's a...
You love the Borg, I know.
The Borg, yeah. Yes, I just obviously added the film to that season as well. Yeah, it's... I really don't like when they, we talked about this in titles, but I hate when they have the same name for an episode and a movie. It gets very confusing. But
I can't wait until the film, the next film, which I believe is going to be called Star Trek: Who Watches the Watchers.
But you've also just got
In Latin.
Oh no, no more Latin titles. You've also got gems like Remember Me, the Crusher episode, which I thought was fantastic. Kind of ties with Clues, where it's that high concept kind of idea. But again, a great Beverly episode. You've got The Nth Degree, another really great Barclay episode. In Theory, which was Patrick Stewart's directorial debut, was it not?
I believe it was, but don't quote me on it, but I'm pretty sure you are correct.
Yeah, where we get to see Data's relationship with a female member of the crew. And I think that is a really interesting episode for what it does to Data. There was so little that I disliked this season. Like, The Loss was the one I noted as the, oh God, no, please no, don't make me watch The Loss. But even in just kind of the mediocre, I had stuff like, I put Identity Crisis, Devil's Due, Suddenly Human. There's a few in there that I would just kind of shrug my shoulders at, even if there is some good elements to them. But overall, everything kind of falls in that, if there's not, you know, the standouts that, you know, we've named, there's really good episodes. It's a very consistent season, which I wasn't surprised that afterwards when I went online, I was just curious after I'd written my ranking to see which, you know, sort of order people ranked them online. And a lot of people put season 4 at number 1, I noticed. I thought that was actually really interesting.
Okay, I will. I feel confident not putting season 4 at number 1, but I'm not going to fault somebody who does that, because honestly, I think that the season that I want to put at number 1, I think you and I can have a debate perhaps going into the next category, but I feel very confident about it. It's very strong and cohesive in a way. But just before we get into maybe the final two picks, Cam, though, you had pointed out, you know, it seems as if season 2 had been building on top of what they had sort of set up in season 1. Do you think that season 4 kind of represents kind of the culmination of what Michael Piller was trying to imbue across, you know, this new writing staff? Because there's a lot of turnover, and it feels as if people finally kind of got with the program that Michael Piller was setting out here, and that's what we get with season 4.
Well, yeah, I have to believe so, because season 3 feels like a show struggling with itself. When you're opening with, you know, I mean, with Evolution and the Ensigns of Command and the Survivors, like, that feels, they're better than your average season 2 episode, but they don't feel unlike scripts that could have happened in season 2. And it feels like over the course of that season, they're kind of wrestling the show into what they want it to be. So it would make sense to me that when they've done Best of Both Worlds at the end of that season, that it's like, okay, you know, basically they've been shot out of a cannon into season 4. Let's go. We've learned the lessons. We've gone through the growing pains. And so let's, and not to confuse it with the TV show Growing Pains, you know, it feels like with season 4, they had figured out their characters, they'd figured out what made a, like, strong episode of TNG, and they were ready to go.
It's just interesting, though, because, you know, Michael Piller was very close to leaving the show after season 3. He said he didn't have plans to come back, and he kind of wrote himself into a corner when he did the Best of Both Worlds two-parter. He had to kind of figure it out himself. But we also had, like, the loss of, like, Iris Stephen Bear. But look, I think that it's just great that Piller stuck around, kind of, you know, righted the ship, so to speak. And look, the results are right there on the screen.
Well, I'm trying to remember, what was the reasons he was going to leave? Was it just fatigue from season 3?
Yeah. It was a lot of work.
Yeah. I have to imagine probably season 4 was a lot of work as well, and 5.
Well, I wonder how much he was being tempted by some hefty bonuses and maybe the prospect of developing his own Star Trek spinoff, though. I wonder if Rick Berman was just tempting him with that.
But also, I mean, when you're working on season 3, you don't know that the show has really turned around. You don't have proof. You don't have, you know, fans at conventions very much telling you this show has really gotten good. Whereas I have to believe, like, not necessarily when they started season 4, but there would have been a general vibe of, like, people are digging this show. Like, it doesn't feel like the first couple seasons where people were angry about what it is.
Is it unfortunate that Discovery also made a turnaround on season 3, just in the wrong direction?
Yeah, no kidding. Like, you tend to look at season 3 as, like, for Trek, the magic season, when you look at TNG onwards a lot of the time. But Discovery, yeah, I don't really know what they learned in season 3. A more cohesive writing staff. Boy.
Was it? There was the guy that was the prominent black writer who quit the show because of HR issues. That seemed fraught with some potential drama there. They just, behind the scenes, it always seems to be a mess on Discovery.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, one thing I've, you know, learned doing research on so many film productions is that sometimes a mess doesn't really matter. Sometimes mess can actually lead to great things. Sometimes you almost need that conflict to generate something great. That doesn't seem to be the case with Star Trek Discovery. Like, the chaos behind the scenes doesn't seem to be aiding the show.
No, no. All right, Cam. Well, I guess we can debate the final two here because, you know, whatever we pick next will influence the others. So maybe we can have kind of an open debate here. For me, I feel confident about what I believe to be the second best season of Next Generation, mostly because I feel very confident about what I think the first is. Do we want to, I don't know, count to three and simultaneously reveal our choice for second best, and then we can debate it from there?
Okay, why don't we do that? That sounds fun.
Sounds fun? Okay, so 1, 2, 3, season six. Oh, okay. We agree on that, sir.
Yeah, I bounced back and forth on season six, though. Was it for you fairly clear-cut, or did you struggle more?
It was clear-cut because I look at season five, and this is Star Trek The Next Generation at its very best. That was what it came down to for me. But you've got some exceptional episodes like Lessons. Like, those are small stories. Those are small character-based stories in which it feels as if the stakes matter for our main characters, Picard and his girlfriend, Commander Darren, in this case. You've also just got stuff like total like fan service that should kind of like make me roll my eyes, but like bring back Scotty and Relics. Like, that is a blast to see. Tapestry, that is, Cam, I think I told you, like, for my birthday, my pandemic birthday last year, not a whole lot to do, but that was the episode that I introduced my girlfriend to of Star Trek The Next Generation before she did this deep dive on her own. Like, Tapestry is just this exceptional episode for us to really come to grips with who Picard is as a person. It's the character stuff that they do so well by the time you're in season six.
Yeah, no kidding. And at this point, they have really figured out their characters. And season seven, they know their characters, but they're getting bumpy. Like, they're running out of inspiration for what stories to tell. But, you know, you look, season six, they finally write Troy a great episode in Face of the Enemy. It's episodes like those that really matter. And, you know, I also noted you've got the Chain of Command two-parter in season six. And that is the best two-parter in TNG.
Not Gambit?
Yeah, we didn't discuss Gambit when we talked about season seven. Gambit is a rough sit. Like, Gambit is the one that I know we make fun of Birthright the most, but I think Gambit was the one I ranked at the bottom for the actual two-parter rankings.
Okay, I might prefer Gambit over Birthright, just because I think Birthright is pretty rough myself.
Birthright has the benefit, though, of the visit to DS9. Like, it's that crossover thing that's kind of fun, at least.
I guess you have enough interesting stuff with, like, say, Data dreaming and meeting one Dr. Soong. You know, there's enough interesting things going on versus Gambit, which was just, it's kind of a weird one that they thought was going to seem a lot more fun than it actually was.
Well, like, Gambit feels like it could have been a pretty fun one-hour episode, and you start to question, why is it a two-hour episode?
Yes. But yeah, look, season six, there's also just like these little hidden gems. Look, I keep, you know, extolling the virtues of these character-based episodes, but go to an episode like The Chase, which is very more kind of the high concept sort of episode. The Chase is a total blast, though. You know, like, this is where we kind of realize why all the humanoids that we encounter all look rather similar. You know, like, they're having a lot of fun in season six, and I don't get the sense that they're dealing with maybe the fatigue of a very stretched, thin writer's room that you get in season seven, where I wonder how many, you know, fingers are in the pie when it comes to both the Deep Space Nine production running concurrently with TNG. And that really does stretch some of the producers thin to a certain degree, especially if they're tapping some of the same writers.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like with season six, I talked about with season seven, how it felt like sometimes they were just getting kind of weird. And I think there's little hints of that in season six. Like, I don't know that the episode Rascals would have been happening in season three.
I would have loved that. Wesley could have been part of that.
Or
you're dealing with infant Wesley.
Or Fistful of Datas. That's a pretty kooky episode. Even just the idea of dropping Jean-Luc Picard in Die Hard in Starship Mine.
Hell, like, yeah.
That's not the sort of thing you're probably doing in season three, where they're still like trying to establish a certain tone of the show. I feel like at this point they're having fun, but they're having fun in ways that actually work. that actually reward fan, you know, support for the show and are paying off characters that, that we've really fallen in love with. You know, I think it's very telling in season six, you get the two-parter, well, the second part of it, but the Time's Arrow two-parter conclusion, where here's like a two-parter. It's kind of what Gambit isn't, which is like a fun two-parter where the characters get to be kind of wacky, but it really plays very well.
I wonder, do you think there's, I don't know, kind of a sense of competition knowing that they were going to be competing against this brand new spinoff that they're like, okay, let's bring our A game to all these episodes that we're writing?
That's an excellent question. And I wonder how much they could even, you know, lift their heads barreling through these 26 episode seasons. It's kind of like, I remember back in the day, Marvel and DC would compete with each other all the time. But if you ask like the writers who were working at Marvel, they're like, well, we kept that competition going for the fans, but we were exhausted. we were basically going to lunch with those guys and just like talking about how difficult our jobs were. So that may have been it, but you do kind of wonder when you have a show like DS9 that they've announced and is going to be getting this huge marketing push, are we going to be irrelevant? And so maybe it did make them take chances they may not have otherwise. And I think those chances go bonkers in season seven sometimes, but in season six, it feels like they're better calibrated and that these chances paid off in great episodes. I only had two episodes that I thought were like really, really bad in season six. And that was Man of the People and Aquiel.
I would rather watch Aquiel than Man of the People just because Aquiel is just so bizarre. It's a little boring, but there are so many bizarre choices in it. Whereas Man of the People, it's one of those episodes that just makes you uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, I mean, poor Troy. She gets Face of the Enemy in season six. She also gets Man of the People. But it is a bummer when I'm going through and looking at the, you know, Hell No episodes, and a lot of them are Troy episodes. But I was very happy to reward Face of the Enemy, the Hell Yeah. So I guess season six is somewhat balanced out in that regard. But, you know, going back to Relics, early on, that was something that TNG didn't want to do, was to introduce a lot of original series stuff other than the Bones McCoy appearance in Encounter at Farpoint. When you're doing Relics, and that might be my favorite episode of the whole season, just that scene of Picard talking to Scotty on the replicated bridge from the original series Enterprise. The power in that scene of seeing these kind of two worlds together and the idea of now recognizing TNG as being on a similar plane of importance as what TOS was doing, I think is very profound and actually speaks very highly to the level of quality the show was at, where it could do that without seeming desperate or sad. Like, you can picture a bat, like I can kind of picture Star Trek Discovery doing something like this, but it would feel more crass versus what TNG was doing, where there's like a regal like dignity to it.
I definitely think it would be crass trying to bring back Jimmy Doohan on Star Trek Discovery at this point.
Oh no, CG Doohan.
Grand Moff Doohan.
He's actually the future guy from Enterprise they bring back on Discovery.
That would be an exceptional revelation. That would be all for there.
If they did that, I think I would have to like bow down to them, because that would be so out there that you'd be like, well, they're doing things that no one else is doing on television, damn it.
Who do you think is going to be the first notable character from the Star Trek franchise that will get the Grand Moff Tarkin treatment in somewhere in Star Trek?
Like the first one they're going to CG into a shot. I would have said Nimoy, but the fact they keep recasting Spock makes me question whether that will be the case.
Yeah. Do you think they just don't do it? Don't pull a Grand Moff Tarkin? Or do you... I'll give you an answer. I think you're still probably debating it in your head. I think the easiest thing to do would be a James T. Kirk deal. Like, I don't know how long the Kelvinverse is for. If they want to bring them back in the TV series, we discussed this. If they were going to bring Spock back into Discovery Season 2, I think between seasons, we thought the easiest thing might be just, how about a holographic projection of Leonard Nimoy through the view screen, like through like cut pieces. I wonder if they could kind of work something like that with Kirk, but also get Shatner to voice him as well.
Do you want to see a young Kirk in Strange New Worlds?
Not really. I don't. No.
Yeah, like, I kind of feel the same way. I suspect the lure of advertising Kirk in their season will be too much to resist. But I would kind of like it if they took your idea, and that was, like, the ending of Strange New Worlds, was Spock, you know, beaming over to the Enterprise, and Kirk is standing there. That could be really cool.
It's better than the idea of just hiring an actor that looks nothing like him and then putting a lot of prosthetics and making him do the Shatner voice. So, like, that would be disturbing to watch.
I would actually love it if at the end Ethan Peck beams over to the Enterprise, I guess from the Enterprise. I don't know where he's beaming from. He's beaming from the
Farragut.
Yeah, the Farragut. There you go. He's beaming to the Farragut. And it's actually just like current age William Shatner standing there.
No explanation.
None needed, but he's wearing like the gold tunic and everything, and we just run with it.
The exact same authentic one that he wore in season one of the original series as well.
Exactly. I wonder if we've seen that the Star Wars franchise has, well, you referenced Grand Moff Tarkin, and we've seen them. They did that with Carrie Fisher as well. Someone else that
Darth Vader,
someone I maybe won't spoil in case people are behind on The Mandalorian. It's gotten mixed reviews every time. The CG has been very rough, and it kind of pulls people out of the scene. So I'm totally okay with Star Trek being like, that's their thing. We're not convinced it fully works yet. We can hold off.
It's that uncanny valley that they just haven't bridged at this point. I'm just saying, like, why bother? Like, be your own thing. I don't think the fans are going to complain by the lack of bizarre-looking CG, you know, franchise characters.
No, I don't think so. I mean, Marvel has done a fantastic job in their films, but it feels like the Star Wars franchise has struggled. I remember also Pirates of the Caribbean paid God knows how much to make a young Johnny Depp in the last Pirates movie, and that looked horrific. It's not a flawless technology, but I don't know, maybe in like 7 years or something, when Strange New Worlds goes off the air, the technology's there.
Okay, I think Marvel figured out by the time we got to Guardians of the Galaxy and we saw Kurt Russell. But Cam, I remember, what was the Marvel movie with Robert Downey Jr. getting that treatment? And I remember you and I were giggling in the movie theater when we saw him come up with that CG treatment there.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Was that Iron Man 3 or was that like Civil?
No. I think it might have been Winter Soldier. I don't think it was Civil War.
It is Winter Soldier because it ties to the whole parents thing.
Okay. Well, we've come a long way since Winter Soldier.
We have indeed. And also, the first Michael Douglas in Ant-Man, the original Ant-Man, is a little spotty as well.
Yeah. Okay, Cam. Season 5. Here we go, sir. This starts off strong. You've got Darmok and Ro. You're following up a couple episodes later with a really strong one like Disaster. Cam, let's just jump into it. No other season has the inner light. I think this episode just might epitomize just the absolute strength that is season 5.
I mean, how many seasons of Star Trek get an episode like the inner light, as well as an Iborg, as well as a first duty, a cause and effect, a conundrum? I mean, Star Trek Discovery didn't have one episode approaching any of those. In this last season.
You weren't a fan of Sukal?
No, I was not a fan of Sukal. I think that's well documented at this point. And just for the update for the listeners, my sister caught up with the show. She was not a fan of Sukal at all either. So,
oh man, those radioactive man boys, just they're not the ratings grabbers that maybe the writers thought they would be.
Apparently not, at least in the Smith house. But like, this is a season that we talked when we did the ranking, the early seasons of Star Trek. We talked about how insane it was, the run of hits you had in seasons 1 and 2 of TOS. That feels like what we're getting here.
I just think that they're running on all cylinders. They know what works. They know what doesn't work. But they're also stretching themselves at this point. Could you imagine how daunting, you know, getting the assignment of Darmok had to have been and having it come out as strong as it did? Like, this would have had me, like, biting my nails if I was somehow assigned to write something like this.
Well, I have to wonder, do you remember all the behind the scenes on Yesterday's Enterprise in season 3, where it was like a disaster? They were doing frantic rewrites through Thanksgiving, not sure if they could pull that episode off, and then it turned into like a triumph. I wonder if they just got more and more comfortable with these real swing for the fences types of episodes.
I think so. Like, I think that is also what emboldens a lot of the writing staff, is if they're feeling confident about past glories, yeah, stretch yourselves. And I think you'll be willing to take those risks. Whereas I don't want us to just rag on Discovery nonstop, because you and I, we generally like seasons one and two. We had our critiques. But I think the issue with season three, to a certain degree, is like, how many big risks did they take in that season? Like, it came off as more bland than anything else.
I would argue the decision to make Sukal the cause of the burn was a fairly wild swing.
Yeah, I just...
But it's a little bit of the Sub Rosa wild swing in my eyes.
Yeah, I think that's actually an accurate parallel there. So do you think that an argument might be made that this is like the strongest overall season of Star Trek ever produced?
Ever produced? Oh, I don't know if I... Oh, season two TOS is pretty formidable.
But there are a lot more stinkers in that batch than there are in season five of TNG.
Yeah. Yeah, because Violations is the only outstanding one that was a real, I thought, dud in season five TNG.
I mean, you got like stuff like Cat's Paw, you know, in season two of TOS. And just there's a couple episodes like that where you just don't have that big, big dip that you see in The Next Generation.
I think as anyone listening knows, like TOS is the one that I'm always going to fall back on, because that's like where I get my entertainment value, even in a mediocre episode like Cat's Paw. But if we're talking about across the board consistency, season five is, oh boy, like it is pretty tough to beat. The only other episodes I'll note that I think maybe are outstanding misfires are, and I didn't put them in the worst category, but like episodes like Cost of Living with the Wind Dancer and Mud Baths. Imaginary Friend is also, I don't know what was going on in the writer's room that week. And then there's just a few that I thought were kind of bland, like New Ground or Masterpiece Society. But by and large, it is a very consistent run of 26 episodes otherwise.
Do you think when we hop over to subsequent series, because we're still going to rank, you know, Deep Space Nine, you know, Voyager, and the new Enterprise, the new Kurtzman era, will all go together as well. Are we going to have these kinds of dilemmas about like which seasons and where to rank them? In that, for you, you admitted it. Like, there was a lot of issues that you had just kind of stacking them up against each other. Do you think it's going to be a little bit more delineated, a little bit more obvious in the subsequent series that we are ranking?
The one I'm actually the most concerned about is DS9. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like with the story arcs of DS9, it's going to be... That's a whole other factor I haven't had to deal with ranking TOS and TNG. I could just kind of look at a batch of episodes without thinking of the overarching story. And I think DS9 is going to be the toughest of any of the seasons to rank for me. How about you?
I still think that TNG might be the toughest, because by the time you get to seasons 4, 5, and 6, they're all so close to me. Whereas I think I might be able to, you know, kind of find those wedges in quality between some of the Deep Space Nine seasons. I think that one might be a little easier, but not by much.
Mm-hmm. Right. But yeah, I mean, season 5 TNG is pretty unbelievable. It's one of those dream seasons, and people don't, I don't know, do people talk about season 5 as being a dream season? I hear them talk all the time about season 3. But I don't know that they really pat themselves on the back as much as they should for season 5.
Well, the reason I felt so confident picking season 5 as number one, though, is because when I did my TNG rewatch, and I think the last time I did the entire series was maybe back in 2017, 2018. But as I was going through the season 5, I kept remarking about like just how exceptional these episodes were. Like my mind was blown all throughout. And I wonder if people do like these big rewatches. I bet an even greater number of folks will kind of realize that season 5 is peak Next Generation.
Right. And when you were having that thought to yourself, you were watching Imaginary Friend on a loop, right?
With my imaginary friend, yes.
It actually turns out I'm your imaginary friend, and this has been a one-person podcast all along.
Don't shatter my delusions. This is all I've got during the pandemic.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to measure other top-tier seasons of the franchise against Season 5 TNG going forward, because, yeah, I did struggle with 5 and 6, because I bounced 6 back and forth, because 6 has a lot of episodes I'm really passionate about as well. But it just felt like Season 5 was the one that, I think if you ask people, they're going to point to so many episodes from this season as being representative of what TNG is. In particular, you know, Darmok, which we've referenced, Cause and Effect, Iborg, The Inner Light. Like, those are the ones you see in clip reels about the best of TNG.
Well, listeners, I will provide a list of all the rankings on our blog, as we've been doing the last few weeks with a lot of these kind of ranking episodes. But in the meantime, I will share it out loud, how we put everything together. And so starting with number 7, we went with season 1. 6th best, Next Generation, season 2. 5th best, season 7. 4th best, season 3. 3rd best, season 4. 2nd best, season 6. And best season ever, season 5 of Star Trek The Next Generation.
What a package, though. You cut those first two, and you have gold.
Yes.
I think also, when we're doing rankings, I don't think we're ever going to deal with this kind of disparity again between, like, you know, in this case, seasons 1 and 2 versus the rest of the show.
I don't think so, no.
Yeah. And we dealt with that last time as well, with the season 3 original series versus the first two. Like, I think otherwise we have a lot more consistency, even if, like, season 1 DS9 is a little bumpy figuring itself out. It's still, the difference between the rest of them isn't as wide as we had here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Let us know what your rankings of the TNG seasons is. We would love to know if it matches up with ours or if it's completely different. Do you hold season 4 as the number 1 like so many seem to? I'd like to know. Okay, Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Cam, we will be discussing the evolution of the Maquis. They were introduced in Deep Space Nine. We got that story continued on in Next Generation, but they were really, really came into their own in Star Trek Voyager, right?
Mm-hmm. Boy, did they.
Well, we'll get to the bottom of it next week.
Okay, so you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Vengeance Factor, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's REPORTONN, as in neutral zone.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.